It can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
You know success when you see it, or you think you do, the people in the spotlight. But what about those small business masterminds who succeed at making their money work harder? They do that by having a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, which now earns 5% annual percentage yield. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
The countdown has begun. This May, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg, held in conjunction with our official partners, the Qatar Ministry of Commerce and Industry and Media City Qatar, and premier sponsor QNB. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections and gain unique insights. Learn more at QatarEconomicForum.com.
It does show the sort of strain that the market is under this winter.
It's very rare to hear the chief economist of the Bank of England being so frank about Brexit.
I think that what's more problematic for policy in the UK is following these basics so that people make decisions on the basis of the full picture.
Stephen, I would like to have a small rant.
Oh, just a small one. That's a relief.
Hello, you're listening to Bloomberg UK Politics. I'm Caroline Hepke.
I'm Lizzie Burden.
And I'm Stephen Carroll. Welcome to the programme. If you're feeling a bit flattened by your Friday, you've something in common with the UK economy. As new figures have shown, I'll get away with that. Why not? The new figures have shown that the growth in the first 3 months of this year was only 0.1%. I mean, growth is growth, Lizzie Burden, right? We should be pleased with this.
It isn't a recession. If you look at the sectors within the economy, the ones that were worst hit that didn't grow very much or even declined were healthcare, education and transport. So, surprise, surprise, the reason for all this anemic growth is, of course, the strikes. We're going to be talking to Asad Zulfikar about that, our strikes reporter, shortly. But I was also speaking to a former Bank of England economist, Martin Wheel, yesterday about tax cuts. He said you'd have to be asleep at the wheel during the Truss era if you wanted to do them now, but
One of the top government ministers is talking about exactly that, Mel Stride, who we've had in the studio in the past. Look, is this a little bit convenient, given the wrangling on the back benches around the, you know, the desire for tax cuts, that Mel Stride comes out and talks about, well, if people go back to work, we can cut income tax by 2 pence. He gives all of the sort of detailed calculations to the newspapers this morning. I think this is actually a little bit controversial, a bit problematic, because basically he's saying if people get back to work, but who are those people? It's older workers, it's parents, perhaps mums. So it's sort of turning the old conservative focus on perhaps people taking benefits and wanting them to go back to work, and it's expanding that. Is that going to be a controversy?
Yeah, you have to wonder whether it's a carrot the Tories can afford to dangle. And if you expand childcare more, I mean, I was speaking to former Bank of England policymaker Michael Saunders yesterday, who we have spoken to on this podcast about childcare. He's been a strong advocate of childcare. Do you know what, Caroline? He gave the Chancellor a B minus on his childcare reform so far.
That's a passing grade, I should point out.
Would you have been happy with that? I think you were a nerd at school, weren't you?
I think that, I mean, so far, look, the childcare intervention, important as it is still reasonably limited.
Exactly, and that's the point Saunders is making. It's a start, but he needs to do more. And the point that I'm making is, if you spend money on childcare rather than an income tax cut, it doesn't just help to plug the hole in the labour market. It also helps to close the gender pay gap, helps to grow the economy as well.
And I just don't know if a tax cut is an incentive to people who are out of the workforce to come back. I don't. It's a strange sort of attempt to draw a line of causality in two things that are...
Well, also, I think it's incredibly difficult because the Chancellor has talked repeatedly about not wanting to cut taxes. And taxes, as we know, have been raised by the government to levels that we haven't seen since the 50s, even since the war, post-war era. And so actually it's a little bit convenient to talk about tax cuts now when there's no real policy towards that, but who knows?
Seems like an incentive to vote Tory to me.
For some, perhaps. Okay, let's turn back to one of the other big stories today. Strikes back on the agenda, 48-hour walkout affecting train services in much of the country today. For more on this, we're joined by Asad Zulfikar, our strikes reporter here at Bloomberg. Asad, great to have you with us on the programme. So, strikes in the rail network, bad day for commuters. What's happening today?
Well, Stephen, I'm afraid it's a bad couple of days for commuters because today will be the ASLEF strikes and tomorrow the RMT is going on strike, of course, famously headed by Mick Lynch, who everyone now knows and listens to a lot. That's going to make things very complicated for people intent on going to the Eurovision final in Liverpool. But it's also going to be very quiet in city centres throughout the country, particularly because of the Friday work from home effect. And that's not to fail to mention that there are further ASLEF actions due in the coming weeks, which will threaten to disrupt the FA Cup final and, of course, Beyoncé's tour.
Really bad news for our producer, James Wilcock, who loves Eurovision.
It's not the only one. Other Eurovision fans are available. However, we also shouldn't just be worried about trains when it comes to strikes either. Asad, we've got potentially airports being affected in the coming months too.
Soon your own shoes will be on strike, Stephen. airports. So basically it's the Border Force who work for the Home Office. So the PCS recently reballoted 186 or so departments. And about a third of those didn't reach the threshold or else vote yes. So that seems to have been a bit of a setback for the union. However, still the remaining tens of thousands of workers, including those in the Home Office, which was the largest department, which voted yes and passed the threshold. And of course, that means the Border Force who work there are no longer going to be checking passports on certain days, I imagine, this summer and in the coming autumn.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think I can make jokes about this. I mean, I think strike action is incredibly frustrating. I think it's staggering that so many of these disagreements have not been resolved. I mean, we were talking yesterday about how another rail franchise has been taken back into government ownership because the service was so poor. I mean, I don't happen to rely on those train services, but anyone who does must be pulling their hair out. Anyway, there's another big story, though, which I also think is so interesting. This is Amazon UK facing unionization. Obviously, we know that Amazon in the US has been very anti. Why has Amazon resisted recognizing unions? What does it actually mean for the company's future domestically, you know, here in the UK, but in Europe as well?
Well, they certainly have been fighting the unionization efforts, both in the US and here in Europe. It's not just in the UK, but in Spain, Germany and France. I mean, so the union recognition system that is here in the UK is not quite the same thing as happens over in Europe. But regardless, Amazon have resisted efforts over there to basically grant bargaining power to unions. And that's precisely what the GMB union is trying to do here in their Coventry warehouse. So that whole process has been kicked off this morning. They've applied to the CAC and now they have to basically decide whether the Coventry warehouse is a bargaining unit and if that bargaining unit has over half of its staff supporting potential unionization. So it's going to be a bit of a faff, but I've spoken with a lawyer who said that essentially if GMB can maintain the support they seem to have, which is over half the staff, then there's no reason they won't win this fight and actually see the first Amazon union in the UK.
I have to say I was on the picket line, not on the picket line, but near the picket line in Coventry at the Amazon factory back in January when the weather wasn't so warm. And the argument that swirls around these strikes there is that lots of people who, for example, work in the NHS are fleeing to these Amazon jobs because they pay not great, but better than some public sector roles. So the argument against the unions is actually you're getting paid all right.
Yeah.
And that's the Amazon argument, right? Very much. That they're paying a better wage and therefore you should want to work for them.
Yeah, Amazon would argue that they've had a double-digit pay rise since 2018. So they certainly don't believe that this is a necessary thing for greater work conditions. But of course, the union has seen an increase in support. There was only dozens of members last August, I think it was, or last July. Whereas in Coventry, that went from dozens to nearly 700 in the last few months. And it's also spreading to other warehouses in Mansfield, Sheffield and Rugeley, where they're balloting as of today until I think June 9th is when the result is out. So that could see further strike action disrupt other warehouses in Amazon's England landscape.
My parcels.
Well, hang on. My working conditions.
Quite right, Caroline.
Out of the European Union, we are going to be going our own way. So these cases are all increasing in importance. Asad, so great to have you on this topic.
That's Asad Zulfikar, our strikes reporter here at Bloomberg.
So political interviews are a delicate art form. When done right, they can be of national significance, toppling governments, changing the direction of major policies. When they go wrong, though, they can be embarrassing, awkward, just worst of all, boring. Joining us now is the man who's been driving political interviews on British television for decades as the BBC's former director of political programming and now at Sky News. Rob Burley, good morning. Thank you so much for being with us on Bloomberg UK Politics. You've got a book out about your experiences, borrowing a phrase from Jeremy Paxman. Why is this lying, B-word, lying to me? Rob, thanks for your time. I suppose I want to find out from you, with all of your wealth of experience, what you think actually makes the perfect political interview, she says, pulling out her notebook and pencil.
Well, I think it's not just one thing. So there's not this one answer to that question. It could be different things. So if what you are involved in a particular conversation is trying to establish, let's say, whether there's been wrongdoing by a government or they have been deceitful, and you know there's a case to prosecute, then a successful political interview will demonstrate their their guilt in that, if indeed they are guilty. The other way of looking at it is there are interviews that are successful when what we're trying to do is establish some information and find out some what are the kind of driving forces behind their policy decisions, open them up, get them to talk, get them to engage. So it can be a prosecutorial sort of atmosphere, or it can be a kind of collaborative atmosphere. So those are the two poles, I suppose, and sometimes there are things that are sort of in the middle. Does that make sense?
Yeah, Rob, can anyone but Jeremy Paxman get away with interviewing like Jeremy Paxman?
Right, I tell you that much. Because I think that one of the legacies of Jeremy Paxman's extraordinary career in interviewing has been that people try and imitate him a lot, which is not, it doesn't really do him justice. I mean, he was actually, when I worked with him, certainly one of the most kind of considered people. He had his very effective sort of screen kind of moments, but he wasn't someone who just went in there like a bull in a china shop. He thought about things quite carefully. Whereas what you have now is you often have presenters, I'm sure none of you, of course, I know that, but who would seek to be overly aggressive to try and get a moment on social media or something, and think that they want to be a mini Jeremy Paxman. So, different individual successful interviewers have different techniques. So Jeremy isn't the only one that can do it.
How much does social media drive interviews like these now, though? Because that, viral moment can be one of the most important parts of an interview, certainly in terms of who watches it. Does that change the way that the game operates?
Well, it shouldn't really. I mean, I think, if you're seeking just a viral moment, you won't illuminate very much. You'll get a lot of heat. You won't get very much light. I mean, however successful interviews, for example, in the book, and probably the most successful interview I've ever worked on in the sense that it absolutely kind of worked out as we planned it, was an interview with Boris Johnson in 2019 when he was running for the Tory leadership. And there was a very big moment in there where it was revealed that he didn't actually know what he was talking about, which may come as a shock to people. He was revealed as being kind of ignorant about the detail of a particular thing. I won't go into all the details of it, but that was a moment. So you had that as a viral moment. People shared it, et cetera, et cetera. But it was only powerful and meaningful because it actually revealed the truth that was more significant than just a little bit of heat. You see what I mean?
Yeah, and no, I understand. But I suppose, to the sort of social media point, maybe it's relevant to this. Truth and lies. How do you stop a politician lying? I mean, I was watching the CNN town hall, for example, with President Donald Trump that took place in the US yesterday, effectively. And, that is a sort of classic example. The anchor did her best to lie fact check the former president, but he still repeated many of the lies that he has about the 2020 election again and again and again. So the issue of kind of truth and lies is even much more prominent now than perhaps it has been in the past.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the thing, the issue there is that, you know, what we've seen there is a breakdown of the norms. So if there were norms that essentially meant that when you lie, if that could be demonstrated, that everybody, including your own side, accepts it to be the case because it's demonstrated by evidence, then you can operate in a sort of successful political culture. What worries me about what's happened in the US is that, such is the partisanship, that it's as if the two sides have a different set of facts. And even in the face of evidence, evidence is irrelevant to Donald Trump and many of his supporters. It doesn't need to be any evidence of stealing the election in 2020 that actually stands up for them to say it or believe it. That's the problem. There's the breakdown. So, you know, once that's gone, there's really nothing you can do about it until that's restored. And, you know, I think we're all hoping that will be restored in a fundamental way at some stage in US politics. I don't think we're at that stage remotely in British politics. I mean, Boris Johnson had a reputation for being a little bit economical with the truth, but he got into trouble and eventually had to leave office because of, you know, issues related to that tendency. So it worked. So, you know, Trump is a particular case and a scary one.
Well, you mentioned that particularly successful interview with Boris Johnson. Do you reckon every interview has to have a gotcha moment?
Absolutely not, no. And in fact, you know, I sort of reject the gotcha moment as a kind of, it's the reason that gets currency is, I think it came from the US, it's a way of trying to avoid difficult interviews by politicians. They'll say it because that's a way of saying this is just a gotcha exercise. A gotcha only means something or is effective if there's something to get, as in there is something that has been said that's untruthful, or there is a policy that is failing, or, you know, so in and of itself, a gotcha moment has no meaning unless there is a substantive issue at heart. And so you can't characterize the moment with Boris Johnson as a gotcha moment. You can characterize it as a moment when a man who wanted to convince people he was across the detail was revealed as being a man who wasn't across the detail.
In all the years that you kind of were behind the scenes of all of these big interviews, you mentioned Boris Johnson. Were there other political players that you found particularly engaging off camera and perhaps more interesting than they appeared when they were on?
Well, the one that always comes to mind with this, sort of weirdly, is John Major, you know, the former Conservative Prime Minister from 1990 to 1997, who was just a very charismatic person and sort of, I think, I don't know whether he'd learned from it directly, but understood what you get in US politics often, which is that sort of charismatic ability to make the person you're speaking to feel like you're the only person in the room. And Major actually has that in person. Others, you know, there are different. I mean, some people like Theresa May are as bad in real life as they are on television. there's that. They vary. I mean, by no means are they all sort of monsters or bad people. I mean, there's a lot. I think most of them are in it for the right reasons. But yeah, weirdly, John Major is the one that jumps out when I think who's kind of different to what you'd expect.
All right. OK, Rob Burley, thank you so much for bringing us that insight. Your book, Why Is This Lying, B-word, Lying to Me, is out now.
So mortgage costs are set to continue to rise after the Bank of England raised interest rates yesterday by another quarter point. Andrew Bailey has been speaking to Bloomberg about how he thinks the hiking cycle could be near an end so long as inflation weakens. I think it's a great interview to listen to. And he was speaking to Guy Johnson.
We're very much going to respond to the evidence as it comes in. We've not given a direction one way or the other, and that's deliberate. I think we'll now be shaped by the evidence. We expect inflation to come off quite rapidly in the rest of this year. Obviously, we want to see that happen. We think quite a lot of it is in the numbers, as it were, because it's the other side of what happened last year with energy prices particularly. But we want to see the evidence.
Okay. Can you be more specific on the evidence? What evidence will you be looking for?
Well, we've put a lot of emphasis on the risk of persistence of inflation. Now, what I mean by that is, yes, inflation we think is going to come down rapidly this year, but it's got to go all the way back down to the target, and particularly in the core elements of inflation, the more domestic elements as they respond to some of these huge external shocks that we've had, how that works its way through the system. Now, what I would say, however, is that the news that we've had since we last met as the MPC interestingly, has actually not so much really been in those sort of more persistent elements. It's been in some of the more sort of in sort of front-load elements, food prices particularly. Actually, the more persistent elements, you know, services prices, and actually, you know, wage setting in the economy has evolved pretty much as we thought it would.
Would it be fair to say, though, that you are getting close to the end of the cycle?
Well, I'm going to say I hope we are, because this is the 12th consecutive increase in rates. But again, I'll be very clear that we will be guided by the evidence as it comes to us.
Do you understand the frustration that the bank appears to be chasing the data, that you continuously appear to underestimate the scale and the duration of the inflation shock, and therefore at every meeting you seem to be wanting to play catch up to the data that you're seeing in front of you?
Well, we went through a period where we were giving a very clear sense of direction, actually, that, you know, there would be further increases in rates as we thought the evidence would unfold, and we were giving a very clear sense of direction at that point. But as you know, we've moved away from that in the last couple of meetings very deliberately, because we do now think, you know, that not only will it be shaped by the evidence, but we are approaching a point when we should be able to, in a sense, rest in terms of the level of rates. But we haven't seen the evidence yet to give a stronger sense of the read of that. So that's why I'm very clear that we have to be evidence-driven.
The forecasts are based on market expectations. Market
yes.
Pricing. You have upgraded the economic forecasts despite the fact that the market is pricing in 5% interest rates. Are you now saying that this is an economy that can take 5% bank rate in a way that it couldn't before?
Well, we've always said that obviously we will have to set rates to achieve the inflation target. So, and then we obviously take into account the impact that rate setting has on the economy, because obviously that feeds back into inflation. So we do that. And you know, one of the things we are paying a lot of attention to at the moment is the so-called transmission mechanism of monetary policy, how those rate rises feed through into the economy. And a particular issue there is that the housing market and the mortgage market has changed very substantially since the Bank of England last raised interest rates, which you have to go back before the financial crisis for, so that we have a predominantly fixed rate mortgage market now. And that does change the transmission. So in terms of this question about how the economy handles rates, yeah, we look at all those things.
John Cunliffe, it wasn't that long ago that he was talking about the fact that 5% would cause significant distress for mortgage holders.
Yeah.
Is that no longer the case? Is that, well, in terms of your judgment of the situation?
It depends on the context of 5%. You can have 5% rates in all sorts of different contexts. And on the financial stability side of our assessment, we do a lot of work to what we call stress the system. And there we're looking at higher rates in very stressed circumstances. So I would make two points, very positive points here. We currently have a much stronger labour market. And what that means is that we've got a lot more people in employment. Now, that's a good thing from the point of view of when looking at it from the point of view of the stress. The second thing I would say is that the impact so far of the disturbances that we've seen in some parts of the world and some parts of the banking system, while we saw an initial impact on UK credit conditions, actually it's not fed through. We're back to where we were on that. And so far, I think it's very good news that credit conditions in that sense in the UK have not been affected.
So that was the Bank of England Governor Andrew Bailey speaking to Bloomberg's Guy Johnson after the central bank hiked rates again by 25 basis points. The other thing that happened yesterday was the governor seemed to throw his chief economist Hugh Pill under the bus. He admitted that Pill was wrong to say that Britons should be accepting they're worse off. Of course, Hugh Pill got in a lot of hot water for that comment. And I was stood outside the Bank of England in the rain after the decision, and you'll never guess who I bumped into. It was the Shadow Chancellor, Rachel Reeves.
Oh.
Mm. Easy to spot, given that she was wearing a bright red jacket. That did help, I thought.
Very on brand. Well, I asked her what she thought of Pill's comment and her reaction to yesterday's 25 basis point hike. Take a listen.
Well, I know that today will be a day of great anxiety for families and businesses around Britain, who are facing this 12th increase now in interest rates. Already we know in the last 6 months, people have paid an additional £1 billion in mortgage payments because of the Tory mortgage penalty that people now face. the cost of living crisis is not going away. It's very real for people. It's why we've said the government should extend the windfall tax on the huge profits that the energy companies are enjoying to help families and businesses right now with the cost of living pressures we face.
Well, the chief economist of the Bank of England says that people need to accept they're poorer. Is that the right language to be using?
I don't accept that Britain's best days are behind us. If we had a proper plan for growth rooted in economic stability and fiscal responsibility, then we can grow our economy. And as Labour have set out in our economic mission, to have the highest sustained growth in the G7 with good jobs and productivity in all parts of the country. But that takes a proper economic plan, Labour's Green Prosperity Plan, our modern industrial strategy, our reforms to ensure that Brexit delivers and works properly for people and removes some of the trade barriers that we face. If we do those things, we can grow our economy and improve living standards.
That was the Shadow Chancellor, Rachel Reeves, from the Labour Party, standing out in the very atmospheric rain, which I think we all sort of were quite glad that we're indoors now. Lizzie, just after that conversation, you dashed indoors for another important chat about the Bank of England.
Yeah, we had Michael Saunders, as I say, the former Bank of England policymaker. He was once the bank's biggest hawk when he left the committee last year. But now he says that his concern is that the bank undershoots the inflation target. So I asked him what he made of Rishi Sunak choosing his top priority to be halving inflation by the end of the year. And he said it's about as ambitious as promising that the sun will rise tomorrow.
OK, well, let's see whether the PM manages to make that target then by the end of the year. Lizzie, thank you so much for that. We'll be back, of course, next week. That's it from us for today.
But before that, Caroline, there's the Eurovision to get over.
There is.
How excited we all are about that, says the two other people in the studio who are not at all excited about it. It's a great night out or night in if you're watching it. Sweden and Finland among the promising favourites, but you never know. I mean, there's always a surprise. There's always this dilemma in Eurovision world of those the fan favourite songs that never tend to be the ones that win. Think of poor old Eleni Ferreira in Fuego a few years ago getting into Eurovision fans. But look, bound to be a good night in if you're in watching it. It's always good fun.
Well, there's
plenty to laugh at.
The thing that caught my eye is what you told me earlier this morning, which is that 180 million people around the world watch Eurovision, and that by far tops, you know, anything.
The likes of the Super Bowl, which is always
the
comparative
or even
one.
The big footy.
I'm not alone as a Eurovision fan.
This is a politics podcast, though, and isn't it that Sweden's going to win because everybody likes Sweden?
It's actually because they have a former winner competing for them, I think, which might help them as well. But anyway, that's enough Eurovision chat. That is all from us for today. You'll find, if you like this programme, don't forget to subscribe. Give it 5 stars so other people can find it on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen.
This episode was produced by Chris Pitt and our audio engineer was Marufa Hussain. I'm Caroline Hepke.
I'm Lizzie Burden.
And I'm Stephen Carroll. We'll be back with more on Monday. This is Bloomberg.
Bloomberg UK Politics. Listen weekdays at noon on DAB Digital Radio in London.
Collaborate for a greener future at the Bloomberg Green Festival, a groundbreaking celebration of the thinkers, doers, and innovators leading the way, from design and culture to technology, science, and entertainment. Hear from inspirational speakers and immerse yourself in climate solutions, July 10th through 13th in Seattle. Title sponsor, Amazon. Official airline, Alaska Airlines. Get 20% off using promo code RADIO20 at BloombergLive.com/greenfestival.